Registry Matters is an independent production. The opinions and ideas here are that of the hosts and do not reflect the opinions of any other organization. If you have a problem with these thoughts, FYP.
Recording live from FYP Studios East and West, transmitting across the internet, this is episode 67 of Registry Matters. Larry, how the hell are you tonight?
Well, I could be better. It's very fatiguing to be in the final week of session, but I think I'll make it.
Outstanding. Maybe you don't want to even answer this question, but there are two things that I would like to ask you about and see what, we'll just do this one. There are, I think, 19 states that have signed on to a compact of the majority rules in the presidential election instead of doing the delegates. Do you follow anything like that?
We have such a measure pending in our legislature here. Yes.
Really?
The popular vote. Yes.
And can we, I don't want to get in the partisan side of it. I'm curious your thoughts on the subject. And like, I see that it could be a good thing, but it's also, it might turn out to be a bad thing in the end.
Well, I hate to divert because I'm happy to answer the question, but I like to tell stories if you haven't noticed.
And
I didn't think you had.
No.
And I like to say that before we shouldn't do things to get back at, we've had a couple of minority presidents recently in most of our lifetimes. We've got the current president who didn't get the majority of the vote. And then we had George W. Bush who in 2000, who didn't get the majority of the vote. And this is eerily reminiscent of what reminds me of the changes that they made to keep a president from running for a third and fourth term, the two-term limitation. There were people who were very angry that Roosevelt had been elected four times. Now, he didn't serve, but just a fraction of his fourth term. But they changed it. Well, guess who probably the first president was that could have been elected to a third term? Well, all that vindictiveness on the Democratic side, against the Democrats, because Roosevelt was a Democrat, they probably could have had a Eisenhower for a third term if he had wanted it, but he wasn't allowed to. And they possibly could have had Reagan for a third term because the evidence is that George H.W. got elected, which was a friendly transition. So be careful when you're doing things out of vindictiveness. I think you need to actually more carefully analyze the reasons for this movement and why we make the change. And it reminds me of the daylight savings time debate. And I just had this today, so it's fresh on my mind. The Uniform Time Act Congress passed in 1966, establishing daylight savings time. And it was initially 6 months on, 6 months off.
Right.
And then as the years have gone by, they've extended the onset, the changing the clocks earlier and earlier. So it's no longer a 6 month on, 6 month off. You know, it used to be the last Saturday night in October and the last Saturday night in April, you change your clocks. You had 6 months on. Well, there was a brief intermission from that in 1973 when we had the Arab oil embargo. And the change was to put the nation on year-round daylight savings time because it was going to save a bunch of energy. We were going to have Americans out when there was still light, and it was going to help us make up for the shortfall that we were suffering from the embargo, and it was an energy efficiency act. Well, I can't tell you how many months it was before Congress repealed that. I can tell you I don't believe it was greater than 1 year before they repealed it, because we had children getting struck by cars in the morning because you've shifted the daylight in the morning to the evening. So in the wintertime, you had the particular rural areas where these kids were getting hit by cars. Well, what I asked the person today that I had the debate with, I asked him, I said, well, I'm amenable to changing things because time changes, but can you tell me what has changed since 1973? The distances in rural areas from where kids live to their schools probably is similar to what it was in 73. I guess we could think kids are a whole lot smarter and alert now than they were in 73, but no one has shown me any evidence of that.
I was going to push back on that one.
cars are a little bit smarter than the board. Maybe the cars will spot the kid before they hit him. I'm not sure. But school buses, I look at the school buses today, and they look very eerily similar to the ones we rode in 1973. I suspect they might have a restraint or something for seatbelts. But the bus looks like there's no difference in the school bus that you can see visibly from the outside. I would like to know what has changed since 1973 that would make it where children would not get hit today if we go on year-round daylight savings time? Or is that just acceptable collateral consequences because there's so much evidence that shows that the good outweighs the bad? And the good, of course, I've seen a lot of evidence. They just pile it in here on us saying that that people will be healthier. There's fewer heart attacks. The work production, it takes a couple of weeks before people's work product. I mean, they've got tons of research. So maybe it's just okay to have that collateral consequence. That's what, but they, of course, no one will tell me that. But what the equation is to this, if society has changed sufficiently enough since the founding days, that there's no reason for us to have that anymore, that it doesn't serve the same purpose, then we could revisit. But I'm kind of thinking from what I've seen, it still serves the same purpose that it served in the 1700s. The Electoral College serves the same purpose.
I don't want to appeal to antiquity and say that they had it right because it's old. I don't want to go willy-nilly change something just because perhaps we don't like the outcome that has happened this go around, but I don't know if they decided to do it this way for a reason. And I would want to make damn sure that we know why they made it that way. And we are convinced and we can provide compelling arguments on a reason to change it.
Absolutely. And the reasons I've been provided to me make no sense, but to the people that are making them make sense. The overwhelming majority of the contact I'm receiving is in favor of the change. But they say that our little state with 5 electoral votes doesn't count. But I see it just the opposite. If those five electoral votes would have made the difference in 2000, of course, our 5 electoral votes in 2000 went to Gore. But that would have been enough to sway the election. But they say that we'll get more attention. I don't know how we would. It seems like to me, if you're just trying to tally up the masses of votes and get more millions of votes, it seems like to me that you would campaign in the states that have people. And it seems like to me, states like Wyoming and Montana and New Mexico that don't have any people, I can't imagine how you could run your vote total up to go to a state that has no people. I'm at a loss on that one.
Right.
To me, I'd spend my time in California and New York and Texas and Florida. I would go to the population centers. I just can't understand how their logic flows.
Yeah, I guess from that side of it, it would transition it from being just a handful of the whatever it's the four or five just swing states, the Ohio's and the Pennsylvania's and stuff, and it would switch to places that are just going to give you the biggest bang for the buck.
Right. If you're just on a vote getting operation completely, you would just concentrate on the large states and trying to really run up the margin in the large states. And then you could say to hell with the small states. They got 100,000, but they got 600,000 people. What difference does it make if the opponent gets 70% of the vote there? It still isn't going to amount to anything.
Yeah. I was just curious what your take on it is, because I think Colorado may be the most recent one to do it.
I haven't followed which states have jumped on that bandwagon, but I would not be surprised because they would fall into the category of being the ones disappointed about the recent results. But I'm not sold yet. I'm open to hearing the arguments that are compelling, and they have not been presented. And the same thing on the time change. That bill may make it through the legislature, but all you listeners out there that are a whole lot smarter than I am, tell me what has changed since 73 that would make kids so much safer than they were in 73. I mean, if the school calendar, the time looks just about the same. They run a traditional school calendar still in the majority of the country. So the schools are getting underway about the same time they were in 73. The schools are starting to fill up around 7:30 each day. They have their early morning festivities before they start classes, but usually classes have started by 8:30, 9:00. Nothing's changed since the 70s. So I don't understand, unless kids are glowing in the dark now because they've got so much radio. I don't understand how the kids would be more visible today than they were in 73. Maybe the lights are better on cars than they were in 73. Remember, we had just those single round lights every car had the same light, and you had to align them with these fancy machines they had and the screwdriver, and you'd constantly adjust the screw, and then you put the alignment thing in front of it and see if it was shooting straight ahead.
Certainly.
but I'd like to hear what is different that kids are going to be safer now than they were in 73 and 74.
And I'll make two closing points. It is garbage to have Halloween at, 6 o'clock at night and the sun is still out. I think that sort of defeats the whole purpose of Halloween. The second thing is that they made a change in like 2005 or whatever, where it, squished things back to be this like 4 month long thing. From an IT point of view, holy crap. It made nightmarish kind of changes required. Cause they were almost like hard coded to handle the time change of exactly when it was. And then they put in this thing. So you had to get patches for everything. Cell phones couldn't handle the update. It was really nightmarish.
Oh, I remember that. Everything, when you bought a VCR, if anybody knows what a VCR is that's listening, all those things were programmed for the time change because it was 6 months on, 6 months off. Yep. So all it had was a basic calendar, and it knew when it was the last Saturday in October, it was time to go backwards, and it knew when it was the last Saturday in April, it was time to go forward by an hour. But now it's all over the map.
Yep. All right. So let's cover a listener voicemail about the hysteria of the registry.
Hi, this question is for Larry. I was calling specifically to try to address the current hysteria that we're facing with the registrants and parallels between the Civil War. And I was wondering, since you were around during the Civil War, if you could give us a rough idea of how similar the hysterias are and whether there's anything we can do to overcome it like we did the hostilities during the Civil War. And I thank you very much for your time, and FYP.
That has to be one of the best questions we've ever gotten.
So, since you were around during the time, you were the strategy guy after Lincoln was assassinated. What do you think about the hysteria of the registry?
Well, I guess there is. I guess there is some similarity, though. There was a lot of people who felt that the Union should have made the Confederates suffer more before they were readmitted, and the people who helped the underground movement of slaves to the free North were vilified, and they were ostracized if they were ever outed. So he's actually not completely off the wall. You had to do what you did in secret back in those days. I remember them vividly.
Yes, I imagine you do. Oh my God.
So yes, the people who broke from that, there are people out there who actually are afraid to speak against the registry because of it so popular with the masses. There were people out in that era that knew slavery was wrong, and they knew one human should not own another one, and they knew that was wrong, and they were terrified to speak against it and to try to do anything. Everything was done in secret. So it's not a direct parallel, I don't think, but I think there's some similarities. So, and the fact that he remembers that I was around in those days, I really am flattered.
All right. Well, let's move on. That just makes me giggle. So we have kind of a theme tonight of privileged white men and Washington Post. Those are the two parallels. Those are the two, the big themes for the night. The first article comes from the Washington Post, and it's Why Prisoner Abuse and Deprivation Persists in America. And I don't remember, maybe it was a month ago, 3 weeks ago. I know we covered it when Josh was on, and it was about the jail, the detention, whatever, in Manhattan. And like the power had gone out and people are like practically freezing to death. And it was right when the Arctic blast thing came through and it's 20 below zero, whatever. And it's a long read, but good grief, man. We really do treat our people like crap in prison. And it just, why do we have this like vengeance and we just want to get that extra little pound of flesh just every time and just beat people down into the dirt?
Well, I read the article and the guy's name escapes me at the moment, so I'm going to open it again.
Spencer Weinrich.
Apparently his writings had a lot to do with our philosophy about corrections in this country.
Oh, you're talking about the Panopticon, like the original author? Okay.
Yeah.
I'll find it here in a second. The last name is Bentham.
Bentham, yes. It's he had these doctrines about the person in prison had to be treated less well than the poorest and the most underprivileged among us, or else his theory was that everybody would want to go to. I mean, he didn't say that in the article, but it is maybe he did in his writings. But it looks like his theory would have been that otherwise everybody would be signed up to be in jail. But we have this thing about the confinement is not enough. We want people to suffer. It's not the Holiday Inn, and that's ingrained in us. The masses, if you went out and picked 100 random citizens and you asked them, what is the purpose of incarceration? They'll tell you punishment.
Right.
That'll be the first thing out of 65 or 70 of their mouths, maybe even more. And you say, well, punishment, what does that mean to you? Well, they need to suffer so they can think about what they did. And you say, well, don't you think just merely being confined away from their families is no. They should have it hard. But he goes through all this stuff about how they made lots of money from exploiting prison labor, which to some degree still happens today. That's what we were talking about.
Yes.
I don't know, Andy, why are we the way we are? I think it's because of what we've been taught. That's what those are our values that have been instilled in us as we grow up, that people who've done wrong need to suffer.
It feels to me that if you have any sense of comparing us to other nations, that the European countries put us on some sort of even scale from an economy, from human rights, things of that nature, and they have a significantly lower population. They have a significantly lower recidivism rate. I can't imagine that they have significantly lower criminality. They just don't beat you into the dirt the way that we do here. And I really struggle with why we can't be. It feels really what's the word I'm looking for? It feels the contrast is really striking to me, because statistically they are significantly less religious, but they are significantly more forgiving. We are a much higher religious country, and we are significantly less forgiving of people.
I think you might be onto something, Andy. I've been noticing that most of my adult life that we preach a lot of forgiveness, but it's hard to find much of it in this country. And the countries that have a lesser reliance on those values, and I don't want to offend anybody more than I have to, but the people, the nations where it's less of a dominant force, they seem to build systems to rehabilitate and to forgive and give second chances without any religious bent at all. And when people try to draw out my religious beliefs and I tell them I don't think it's relevant, I said my values are solid, I think. And they say, well, where do they derive from? And I said, well, they don't have to derive. I mean, do you think you have an ownership of morality and values? It seems like to me that you don't. It seems like to me you can be a moral person with values because it's the right thing to do. You can base it on how you'd want to be treated. And I think these European countries have just done a deeper study rather than just putting their finger to the political winds of what the masses want. And I think they've realized society is better as a whole if they take a slightly different approach and incarcerate fewer people for shorter periods of time with the goal of returning them as productive citizens. That just seems like a better social policy to me. But I don't know how
I have another hypothesis for you. Because they are taxed at such a higher rate that they want every person in the system to try and collect all those taxes.
Well, most of the countries we talk about do have higher rates of taxation than we do in America.
I'm wondering if it's not there just to get them back in the system to collect the revenue. I don't know. Just a thought. I don't know.
But I think those taxes are levied to make for a fairer, more just society, and I think it's that collectively they've decided that we're better off if we have a fairer society where everybody feels like they have the opportunity to participate. We've got a significant number of people in America who feel shut out. Now, I know you've got some conservatives out there listening to us who say they're not shut out; they can make anything they want to do with themselves. But I challenge you to go to a facility that serves homeless, provides basic services, and look at the condition most of these people are in, whether it be mental illness or whether it be addictive disorders, whether it be you name it that they're suffering from. They're not anywhere near employable, and it would require significant undertaking to get many of these people, and I can't give you a specific percentage, it may vary from city to city and from shelter to shelter, but these people have deep problems that just simply saying pull yourself up by your bootstrap is not a solution.
Interesting.
And I think we benefit more if we have those people producing at the best of their ability rather than running around with shopping carts. I don't understand how that's acceptable.
Well, moving on to an article from Yahoo Sports. Maybe you recall the Oregon pitcher that couldn't get drafted. He was like this super hot pitcher and should have been something like a first round draft pick or something close to it. I don't really follow these sports things, these foosball kind of operations. But
I recall it quite well. That would be Luke Heimlich.
Yeah, Luke Heimlich. And he got signed to a Mexican league. So I guess he's going south of the border and he's going to be a pitcher down there. I was really trying hard to see if it would say anything about, like, is he going to be like on, is he a starter? I don't know what they do in baseball. Is he going to be out there on the mound game one? Did he get a decent salary? Is he making 20 grand a year and he's going to still be like eating peanut butter and jelly sandwiches?
Well, I can assure you that the Mexican league doesn't pay as well as the National League or the American League in this country. They wouldn't have the lucrative contracts, but it illustrates one thing clear to me is that in this country, he, according to the accounts of the article, he could have been in the starting rotation of any of our professional baseball teams. He's that good. But because of the registry and the hype and the sensitivity and the fact that the National League and the owners didn't want to deal with all that distraction, he was too much of a distraction. They don't have that distraction in Mexico because they don't have a public sex offender registry. The registry is the problem, folks. Without he would be playing baseball in the United States.
Right. And there's just one little sentence in there. It says several MLB teams, including the Kansas City Royals and Baltimore Orioles, considered picking up as a free agent, but were worried about the potential backlash from doing so. There
Absolutely.
We go, folks. We got like a person that you could put at the top has this an elite skill set that is you're born with it, you're trained into it, and just all the right factors come into play. And because of a mistake, you cut them off at the knees and the kid's got to go south of the border to play baseball, which now, I would suspect he's not going to do poorly. He's just not going to make $12 million a year or whatever it is here.
Now remember, folks, in our forgiving country, he did this crime when he was 15 years old.
And he's 23 now. Yeah.
We're not talking about a person who was a hardened, perverted criminal, repeat offender. We're talking about a juvenile. And the only reason why he got exposed is because his conviction from Washington, there was these vigilantes fishing into the registry list, and they demanded that they be released, even though he was not listed publicly. And they got the list, and they outed him. As I keep saying, the registry is the problem. Whether or not it inflicts punishment directly, it's certainly inflicting a lot of punishment on Luke, isn't it? Because he was basically drummed out of baseball in the United States.
Here's a really awesome statement from the media director, Juan Alanis. He is welcome like any other person that comes to give the best of himself and try to get a place on the roster. Why don't we have that attitude?
Because we're more sophisticated than other nations. I don't know why you don't understand that.
Build that damn wall. That's what I got to say. Build that wall, because those people are not fit to be Americans.
Well, you're going to try to run off the remaining listener we've got.
All right, before I go on another tirade, so let's cover The New Yorker, and it's a Harvard Law School professor defends his decision to represent Harvey Weinstein. This is tough. So Harvey Weinstein is the media mogul who has, like, I don't know, something like 50 accusations of doing nasty things to women and so forth. And here is a Harvard Law School professor that is willing to sit on the rest of the defense team to try and defend the guy. There's not a lot of information because he kind of sidestepped most of the questions because he's like, I'm not going to answer any questions about the case. And he's not going to answer any questions about the decisions of the attorneys before him and so forth. But kind of interesting. Here's somebody that says he deserves proper representation just like everybody else.
That was the reason why I put the article in here. And he's facing criticism from the students there at Harvard. And I just don't know what the alternative would be. I'm guessing that these students who are criticizing, and it's probably beyond the student population, but this was particular about the students at Winthrop House, which I had never heard of Winthrop House until I read this article. So those who are more brilliant than I can explain what Winthrop House is. I guess it's a dorm, some housing within the Harvard University, but the students are criticizing Mr. Sullivan, Ronald Sullivan Jr. And he does go through an interview and he does decline to answer some questions. But in an adversarial system where it is dueling parties, what would you want Weinstein to have? No one at his side? Is that what the people are wanting? That we would put him in a duel with nothing to joust with? I mean, is that what you people want? He's entitled.
That doesn't sound like a bad idea. I mean, he's guilty because he's been accused, right?
Well, that's what Sullivan said, is that the mere accusation, he's presumed guilty. That's in the interview here. And it's a long interview, but people who are bored with time on their hands, he does answer he does answer some significant questions, and I just can't believe that you would be against him having representation. It baffles me that I would say that probably the people don't understand our system that would feel that way. He's entitled to the presumption of innocence, and he's entitled to representation.
I do keep hearing, particularly with the like the 20 or whatever presidential candidates on the Democrat side, they are coming out almost with slogans that say, believe the woman. And while I don't want to discount that a woman has had a traumatic experience, or anybody has had a traumatic experience, I really don't want to discount it. But I just don't know that it's fair to just like walk in and say, believe the woman, just like the Smollett thing. And I'm sure we're going to have comments about that here in a little bit. But you just can't believe them. You have to validate it and then believe it. Otherwise, it's an anecdotal piece of statements.
Then we need to scrap our system altogether, if that's where you want to go with it. Our system is not based on believing anything. It's based on evidence that supports the accuser. And the accuser has the burden to show beyond a reasonable doubt.
Didn't I tell you about me sitting on jury for that, though? There was a DEA officer here in town, and he was being civilly sued by a confidential informant. She had zero credibility. She was a drug addict and all this, and she had claimed that he coerced her, forced her, whatever, to take some nude photos, some Polaroids, and she was like, he took these photos, and I'm suing. Okay. And I was like, I believe he did it. Show me the pictures. Innocent. I was like, show me the pictures. So we found him not guilty because there was no evidence.
Well, I mean, there was some evidence. There was her allegation, but
yeah, sure.
Beyond her evidence, there was no corroboration. And what they're asking is that we go down the slippery slope where there's no corroboration for any accusation. And that's dangerous. And that's what people are not thinking through very carefully. You show empathy for any victim of a crime. Smollett should have been shown empathy when he came in looking bruised and beat up. But the empathy stops where you start giving delving for the evidence to support, so that you can go look for the perpetrator and make sure you've got the right person, and you're putting the right person in a cage for a long period of time. And we need to have evidence to do that. And of course, his story, although some might have said he was being victimized, he was not being victimized being asked for evidence. Neither is a person who makes a sexual accusation. There's nothing victimizing them saying, okay, well, we've got to get further into this because we're looking to take someone's freedom away for a long period of time. And the burden is on us. We've got to prove this. And that's the way it should be. And I'm surprised that people don't want it to be that way. Of course, they will magically want it to be that way when they start losing their freedom just because someone said something, when they start getting caged for long periods of time. Then magically they'll say, how did we get to that point? We got to that point because of people like you, who are not standing firm for presumption of innocence and requiring proof beyond a reasonable doubt.
Absolutely. Well, another long read comes from the appeal. And actually, I shouldn't say long read because this one isn't as long as some of the articles from the appeal. This one's a little bit of a twist, though. This one is, woman faces life in prison for sharing drugs with another woman in jail. And as best as I can tell, so this the woman is a druggie, and she put some drugs in where the sun doesn't shine. She ended up getting arrested. And then while in custody there, I guess in like lockup, she gave what she had to a person in the same cell as her, and she died from taking the MDMA, I think. Maybe that's not what she took. But anyway, so the woman in the same cell with her dies from an overdose, and they're going to now charge the woman with homicide for passing a fentanyl trafficking. No, I'm sorry. That's not it either. Anyways, well, the woman died from a drug overdose.
It is fentanyl trafficking law.
It is?
Okay. Trafficking, yes. And I don't know what the hell fentanyl is, but somebody smarter than I am can tell me, but it doesn't sound very good.
But so just by passing the drug, and so some people before we started the show said, yeah, I mean, like you could give something of a wrongful death, but is it homicide?
So, well, let's just go to since I'm really not well-versed on what fentanyl is and quantities. It says the law created mandatory minimums for fentanyl possession, including a minimum of 3 years for 4 grams. I don't know if 4 grams is a gallon or if it's a bushel or what it is. It doesn't sound like very much, though. I mean, how much is 4 grams?
Small. How about that? 28 grams is an ounce, so 4 grams would be tiny, tiny, tiny.
Okay, so then you got to get the mandatory minimum of 4 years for 3 years for 4 grams, 15 years for 14 grams. Now you say that's a half an ounce, right?
14 would be half, yes.
Yes. Okay. So you're talking about 25 years for 28 or more grams. It also cemented first degree murder as a charge in cases where homicide results from drug transaction. In Florida, first degree murder means an automatic sentence of life without parole. I'm just struggling with this because those penalties, if you've got the quantities right, that sounds like a horrendous penalty to begin with for possession. But you haven't killed the person if they voluntarily ingest it. They killed themselves.
Perhaps. For clarification, one of our drug addicts in the chat said that it's a highly potent drug used to manage end-of-life pain situations, if to give some sort of context to it.
Do we have that kind of an audience in this place? What kind of joint are you running?
I'm just picking on somebody in chat.
No, I'm glad that somebody could answer that because I really don't know what I'm talking about. But my consternation is that it's like I pontificated last episode about or the episode before that about rape isn't rape if it's not rape, and if we're going to convict someone of murder, I don't think a voluntary ingestion would qualify. Now, if you held a knife to their throat and said, this knife is going to slice your throat if you don't swallow that, then you're put in a Hobson's choice. If you're going to die with the blade or you're going to die with ingestion. But I don't understand if a person wants to get high and someone helps you get high, I don't understand how they could be convicted of murdering you.
What did I want to say? I had a conversation with someone about this in like the terms being used, and it was agreed upon that to use the term rape for, using a position of power to get involved in something is not the same as something like rape or murder. I think in the conversation we brought up talking about some of these, like, Charles Manson, where he has like totally convinced people to go do his bidding, but here Manson is in prison for forever, right?
Well, he's dead, but yes.
Okay, close enough, whatever. Who's the one that's still in jail then? Who's the one that's like trying to get out?
Some of his followers that did the deeds.
Okay.
He had a harem of women that followed him.
Right, and he got convinced them to go do these evil deeds, and he then got convicted of it. Isn't that the same thing, or no?
Well, now you can, when you're trying to cause the murder, there are statutes that hold you to be the same as if you actually pull the trigger.
Right.
But when you're getting high, I mean, I don't have a lot of experience in this, but I'm assuming you're not trying to die. No one has ever told me that I've interviewed. Of course, if they were dead, I guess they wouldn't be able to tell me. But no one has ever told me that they were trying to die when they were getting high. Usually they tell me that they're trying to feel good. So yes. I'm assuming that this cellmate wanted to feel good, and the one that's being charged with murder says, hey, baby, I got this stuff for you. This is going to help us both feel good. Right. I don't see the requisite intent to kill anybody, and I don't know how you can be convicted of killing somebody that you didn't intend to kill. I just don't believe that without them being able to – I'm just not buying it.
So we have a disagreement of terms, though. So a murder isn't it. Some sort of wrongful death, so however that gets worded in that particular state. But it's not murder. It's not homicide. It's some sort of, I mean, like involuntary manslaughter. If you're driving your car and you cross over the center line and you accidentally kill somebody, you are charged with some sort of vehicular homicide. It's not the same as murder.
Well, It says later footage showed something falling out of Patrick's pants, a small baggie containing a tan mixture. The substance was tested and revealed 2.5 grams of and to contain fentanyl. Patrick told officers that she grabbed the bag after it fell out to prevent the other woman from getting sick. Patrick did not alert authorities, and she tried to throw out the other drugs before the strip search. Well, I think that's a logical thing to do. On November 20th, Patrick was charged with first-degree murder. I'm just not seeing it.
Right. Because first-degree murder is like premeditated and all that shit, right?
That would be what it should be. I mean, it may have bracket crept to be many things beyond that, but first-degree murder ought to be deliberate, willful, premeditated, going out and killing somebody. And I just don't believe she wanted her cellmate to die.
Yeah.
And I don't believe she forced herself. I don't think she forced her cellmate to ingest this stuff. I think this is an example of how our system gets so distorted. Yes, she shouldn't be bringing contraband into a jail. Absolutely. There should be a penalty for bringing contraband into jail. There probably is in every state that I'm aware of. There is. I think maybe that would end the inquiry. She would be charged with introducing contraband to a correctional facility.
Right. Well, here's article number 2 from the Washington Post. How did Jeffrey Epstein get away with it? Congress should inquire. I think this may be the third time that we've covered this particular individual. But here's yet another rich, powerful white dude that only has received 13 months in Palm Beach jail. He is required to register. And if he's in Florida, these could be pretty dismal conditions. However, he's like a 100-something times over millionaire. I suspect he can buy enough property that he doesn't have to worry about.
I think he has an island, if I remember right.
He does. He totally has an island. And he's got super duper powerful friends. His attorney, I would assume that whoever your attorney is, you have some sort of relationship with them. And that is the current labor secretary. Yeah. He has a small Caribbean island and a private aircraft, which, you know, you could buy a Cessna for 20 grand, but I don't think that's what he's got.
So, well, what do you think he has, just out of curiosity?
Considering that he's had presidents on this plane, I don't think they're flying in Cessnas. He's probably got something along the lines of a Gulfstream. So he's got like a G5, which is, I don't know, a $400,000 aircraft or something like that.
Ah, I didn't, just know, as you a guess. I didn't know you could buy anything that cheap.
Yeah, I mean, it's you know, depending on if it's long range or not. I only like passively follow the stuff, but you could easily fly the thing across the Atlantic Ocean and go to dinner in Europe and then fly back, and that's how you're gonna be flying in pretty good comfort at your leisure on your time schedule. So I mean, that's who this particular individual is. But he, how did he get away with it? He allegedly had all kinds of very young women, servicing him and the people that he had in his surroundings.
Well, it does raise that question, which we're going to get more into in terms of the disparity of treatment. I'm one who believes in uniquely tailored sentences and dismissing charges that don't have evidence to support. And since I'm not in deep inside this case to know what the evidence would have supported, I really can't say what they could have convicted him of. But I think, being that there's so many people that have supposedly gone deeper, found so many irregularities, and the person who made the decision is in a powerful position in government, I think it's worthwhile to take a little peek below the surface and see if there was anything of an improper nature that resulted in this very, very soft outcome. And it's soft comparatively. I mean, I'm not being on the registry is not de minimis, but it is de minimis for a person who has the resources he has, because he's able to insulate himself from all the basic things of life that a regular registered citizen would have to deal with. So I think it's worthy of digging a little deeper to find out, but I certainly am not going to claim to know everything about the inside, but it certainly does look questionable.
Yeah. Especially, I don't know, it does trouble me that his attorney is now the labor secretary.
Well, that's the point for the congressional inquiry. If the labor secretary acted outside of Department of Justice, DOJ policies, and they made a deal that was totally contrary to DOJ policies, then what was the inducement for that deal? That's worth asking those questions to find out because the DOJ policies are pretty rigid in terms of how much latitude they give the U.S. attorneys across the country. And you're not generally allowed to dismiss a boatload of serious charges. That requires going up the DOJ food chain and getting some very high approval to do that type of a plea arrangement. So I think it's worth looking at, but I don't want to just throw the whole thing of uniquely tailoring. That's what we've claimed we're for, that each defendant should be treated individually, and they should look at the strength of the case, and they should adjust accordingly, and they should sentence accordingly. But there's nothing wrong with looking.
Yeah, yeah. And we did get another article. This one, God, this one like lit up every social media platform and every news segment on the TVs when it came out on the 8th. It says Manafort's mind-boggling 47-month sentence prompts debate over judicial system's blatant inequities. And, you know, we can talk about somebody that gets like, you know, 5 counts of CP on their computer and they get 400 years in prison. This guy was like, I don't want to discount. I don't want to exaggerate. He was convicted of money laundering and a bunch of other things that are like white collar crimes, tax evasion. And I 47 months, like, I mean, I served 6 years for what I would consider to be less than, but how did he get 47 months? And you and I spoke about it earlier. And to give you like the bluff, the bottom line up front is not that he should get longer. We should reduce everybody's sentences because 47 months is still a long freaking time to be locked up and not have movies, sex, good food, whatever, your freedom. 47 months is a long time to lose it.
I agree with that, Andy. I actually interject an additional consideration that people roll their eyes, and I think it's a serious consideration. As we age, our health declines and our ability to adjust to the rigors of prison life, even what people think is the federal club, although they're really not clubs at all, but it's really hard on an older person. He's right at 70 years old. And now remember, I'm not a Trump supporter, so this probably really shocked people to say this, but he's 70 years old and he's in declining health. And 47 months for a 70-year-old, the factor that I always say should be looked at is if you're dead set on punishing a person, and that makes you feel good, punishing when you give a 70-year-old four years in prison, that's a significant part of their remaining life. And then when you compound the fact that a 70-year-old has been declining health, has all sorts of things that makes it difficult for them to sleep, they have arthritic conditions and bursitis and all types of things I can't even begin to pronounce that make that time much more grueling for them than it does for a 24-year-old. It's enough. Four years is enough of punishment for the guy. Anything that he's going to benefit from prison, he can achieve in 4 years. But it does beg the question, how is it that we're so dead set to sending people away for a dozen years, like former Governor Blagojevich? He's still serving his time for similar crimes, white-collar in nature. That was the Illinois governor that's sitting in the maximum supermax up in Colorado, I think, the federal prison. It's like this is out of context. But how do you justify such a downward departure with our horrendous sentencing? I think we should revisit the horrendous sentencing that we're imposing across the board. And I think that First Step Act is just the beginning of the revisitation. I think we need to look at our sentencing all across the board. 4 years is enough, but who knows what it's going to end up, because he's got to be sentenced at another court next week, I think.
Yeah. There is a, I don't know. I don't even know how to pronounce the guy's last name. There's an attorney, Scott Hetchinger. For context on Manafort's 47 months in prison, my client yesterday was offered 36 to 72 months in prison for stealing $100 worth of quarters from a residential laundry room. So he's going to serve some similar amount of time to Manafort for money laundering millions and millions and millions of dollars for what you could possibly call hostile foreign entities.
Well, he makes a point.
Ready to be a part of Registry Matters? Get links at registrymatters.co. If you need to be all discreet about it, contact them by email, registrymatterscast@gmail.com.
You can call or text a ransom message to 747-227-4477. Want to support Registry Matters on a monthly basis? Head to patreon.com/registrymatters. Not ready to become a patron? Give a 5-star review at Apple Podcasts or Stitcher. Or tell your buddies at your treatment class about the podcast. We want to send out a big heartfelt support for those on the registry. Keep fighting. Without you, we can't succeed. You make it possible.
Yeah. All right, then. So our next article comes from the Washington Post. Yet again, I think this is the last one, too, for anybody that's keeping track. This is good times. I will title this article from my own title, "It is Illegal to be Black in America." A black man was picking up trash outside his home. Then police confronted him. He didn't look in place, Larry. That's what this is. He wasn't picking up trash in the right kind of neighborhood. So the police confronted him about it and made a big stink over him being on his property.
Well, this came on my radar, and it saddens me that we're still. I know that people watch the clip. They're going to say he should have complied. He should have dropped his bucket, and he should have complied, and probably should have. But his reaction was because he's gone his entire life being asked to justify what he's doing and where he's doing it at. And eventually it causes you to snap and say, I've had enough of this, which is what he did. He's in one of my favorite cities in Boulder, where I've given great accolades to the former district attorney there, Alex Hunter, and his chief deputy, now deceased, Peter Hofstrom, about their fairness and their ethics. But this tells me that town has changed a lot. If this is not an isolated incident, if this is actually the way the police are reacting in Boulder now, that town has changed dramatically, because they were a town of a lot of tolerance, as I remember back in the 80s, and they would not have reacted that way to tell a person that you don't belong here, drop that. And it seemed like that the article said that they're going to be doing some intense investigation to find out if those officers were beyond the policy, but it sure didn't look good to me.
So before we get like a bunch of hate mail for like, what does this have to do with the registry? I'm pretty sure we could tie this back to the registry of how much our law enforcement apparatus, as you term it, is not necessarily overfunded, but they are well funded, beyond what we probably need them to be, that they can go on these little, call it a witch hunt, I suppose. And you know, then the registry and our specific issue, how willing they are to just exhaust every amount of resource to try and to get every person that has committed any sort of infraction.
Well, that's exactly the tie-in. The tie-in is the connection of the heavy hand of law enforcement. And the way I was in the Capitol a few days ago, and I was having that discussion with a state police officer. I said, you know, it's, I know you're on the different side of most of these issues than I am, but as far as I'm concerned, the police over-escalate. They rather than de-escalating, they escalate situations, and that's what was happening in that situation there. He could have dropped his bucket, but the police also could have said, well, gee, hey, maybe he does live here. Yeah. Right. Why are we being so strong-armed about this? So my point is, if we fund the police and we give them all the tools they say they need, which we had a guest that said that just because the Border Patrol says that they need it, we should give it to them. And I fired back at that and said, okay, are you ready to give the cops whatever they say they need, whatever authority, whatever tool? I would bet you wouldn't like our country if we didn't draw the boundaries around what police can do and what their procedures should be. I don't think we should let the police do anything. That's how we end up with police and handcuffing 12-year-olds in schools.
That was good times where the resource officer like pushed that girl off of the chair because she was being a bad girl. I mean, she was being kind of a snotty person, but the resource officer like body slammed her.
Yes,
5, 6, 7 years ago.
Yeah, we need to constantly take a critical look at what our police are doing. They work for us just like the elected officials. And people are always fond of, those elected officials work for us. Well, so do the people who wear the badge. And we get to determine what equipment they're issued, what we want them to do, where we want them to be, how we want them to do what we want done. It's not for them to determine how they do everything, where they do it at. And if the City of Boulder Council decides that they don't want their officers out confronting citizens simply because they look out of place, that's their decision, not the police's decision. The police's decision is, if you don't like the policy, you can shop around for departments that have policies more consistent with what you like to work in. But the citizens of Boulder get to decide that.
Let me push back, though, and I don't remember when this happened, but I recall watching the video from the helicopter. Couple complete nut jobs, I want to say this is in California, and they were like loaded head to toe in complete full-on like military tactical gear with like full-on face shields and body armor, and they completely outgunned the police. And I don't know if that's the nexus of when all of the police armament and having everything, like, you know, they're almost a tactical squad in their own little car, but it feels like, because they, you know, all they had was their pistols, but these guys are running around with M16s, and now the police have all of that equipment in their cars. You would have the people saying, what, like, we need to be protected from those kind of people. It's a complete one-off incident. However, should the police be able to respond to any incident at any time, I would have to say that's like impossible. No, they can't, but we could keep giving them and escalating and giving them more gear to get them closer and closer so they can drive 180 miles an hour down the road and catch a Ferrari. So they can have a bazooka in case somebody pulls one out in your local ghetto or something like that.
That's the argument they've been making for decades, that the criminals. So is the answer to try to de-escalate the weaponry that the criminals are carrying, or to constantly, because the criminals are going to respond in kind.
Yeah, what, sure. They're going to get hollow jacket rounds so they can penetrate the body armor. Okay.
So it's like my thing is that the police have to work within the boundaries that we establish. They don't get to set their own rules. And you don't get too many law enforcement officers to agree with you on that. They think that they should police themselves. They should decide how they operate. They should get to define their own equipment, their own SOPs, and do whatever they want the way they want to. Nope, doesn't work like that. Hmm. So, but that was the point of putting this in here, is that I think the police, the city needs to take a very close look at how their police department is operating in Boulder. And it may be time to make some changes.
Perhaps. But we would need the people to like call up their local sheriff or tell their legislature that like this is unacceptable behavior. I suspect that not terribly many people would do that, though.
Well, I suspect in Boulder, unless it's really gone soft, there's a lot of outspoken, that community does respond. I suspect that this has probably been very big news there, and I suspect the community has expressed their distaste for what they saw. And I suspect there'll be a real thorough investigation.
We have never covered an article out of the Smithsonian. So this is from Smithsonian.com. Sleepy suspects are way more likely to falsely confess to a crime. This is right up my alley. That I'll tell you, like from personal experience. Like if you went and joined the military, one of the first things that they do is completely wreck your sleep cycle. Give you like 2 hours of sleep just so you can barely function. They come in, they're throwing trash cans around, and they do this all to do what? To lower your level of resistance so that you will comply and just follow the rules. And that's exactly what this article describes, is they put you in, you know, the interrogation chamber, and they leave you in there. They're barely giving you bathroom breaks. Now you're hungry. Now you're dehydrated. Now they're not letting you sleep. The light's always on. There's always some sort of buzzing noise coming from the lights. And before it's all said and done, you're just like, just whatever you want me to say, I'll say it, sign it. Can I go home? Can I go to sleep? And even there it says some lasting longer than 12 hours, with many exceeding 24 hours. This is crazy. And they say that a lot of them happen from like the midnight shift, which has got to be really bizarre.
And you have a problem with that? For what reason?
Yeah, I mean, I guess if you just want people to admit to a crime so that you can get convictions, if that's the intent, then this is perfect. If you want justice,
we've got victims who need closure, and we've got to find out, but go back and tell them that we found out who did it. And if we can get a confession, that gives closure. I mean, what's your problem with that?
Yeah, I'm with you. This one drives me nuts. This is right up there with like the memory stuff. This is right along the same lines. It feels like in the age where we are, we could have much more scientific-based, evidence-based process of working through cases with people that understand scientific method to get in there and do these things in a proper way that's wholesome and humane and so forth. But feels like we're still running stuff out of like the 20s or something, or when you were coming up in the 1780s.
Well, this is actually very disturbing. Hope people are not taking me seriously. I've known this for some time that interrogation tactics do result in people being worn down to a frazzle, and they end up giving the interrogation team what they want, and then it's hard to overcome that because they use the interrogation confession against you. The best advice that can possibly be given would be that when they say you have the right to remain silent, just say, well, you don't need to go any further because that's what I'm choosing to do. But people don't do that. They don't, and they're not going to do that. No matter how many times they're told that, they're not going to do that. The skillfulness of the investigators are so good, and they offer them little favors. You know, what would you like to eat? Would you like a Big Mac? Well, if you've eaten what they've feed in most county jails, a Big Mac or whatever sounds pretty good. And they build up a little friendship. And then the bad guy comes in and says, well, you know, the good guy, bad cop. That's actually not TV drama. That's real life of the tactics they use. They're very skilled at what they do. And they'll use tactics like sleep deprivation and bring you back to interrogation again and again and again. And people eventually break. And sometimes they break just to get over with. Sometimes they break because they're telling the truth.
Right.
But the best advice is don't tell them anything.
Yeah, as soon as they say you have the right to remain silent, yeah, just clam up and say, hey, when do I get to make that phone call?
And then the Supreme Court recently ruled that you have to keep invoking that right. They can come back after you've invoked it, and you have to continue to speak to remain silent. So you have to come back when they come back and say, you want to talk now? We were here 3 days ago. You have to re-invoke your right. You know, the fact you told them 3 days ago, you don't have anything to tell them. That's not good enough under the Supreme Court doctrine of recent years. You have to speak to remain silent.
Please expand on that. You have to reassert. So somebody comes back in the room and say, hey, are you ready to talk? Your response is still just supposed to be, hey, I exercise my Fifth Amendment. I'm waiting on an attorney.
Well, I don't know that the decision, I'd have to get more of a constitutional expert to know how they, what the reasonable amount of time is to come back after a person has invoked their right to remain silent. I don't remember if it's days. But I think it was the one dissenting, it was Sotomayor or Kagan, one of the liberals said that, well, it spins the right to remain silent on its head because you have to continue to speak to remain silent. So if you've told them, I don't wish to talk to the police, you guys need to go someplace else and get your information to convict me with, that should be enough. But at some point, they're allowed to come back and say, have you changed your mind? And you have to reassert your silence. And like I say, it was Sotomayor or Kagan, said that they can't understand why you have to continue to speak to remain silent.
Interesting. Yeah. And so which side is pushing which way? I mean, it sounds Kagan, liberals
are pointing
that.
Apparatus is saying that we should be offered. We should. So it really broke down on conservative liberal. The justices said, well, there's nothing wrong with it. Good cop coming back and trying to get information at some point in the future, even if you said you want to remain silent, all you got to do is tell them the same thing again. You don't want to talk to them. And that is all you have to do.
Yeah.
But that's easier said than done. You've been incarcerated for about 9 days in a jail with a no bond hold. And they come back 9 days later and say, well, you know, we can help you out here. Have you changed your mind? Would you like to talk to us now? And you've been sleep deprived and you've been food deprived and you've been family deprived and you're more likely to have changed your mind. If they didn't come back, very few people would reach out. Some do, but very few would reach out to the police and say, we've changed our mind. Some people actually do seek the police because they wanted to, that for some reason they want to confess. And I don't pretend to know why they do it, but they do. They'll actually reach out. They'll send a note to a correctional officer and say, I want to talk to detective so-and-so that was here last week, and they'll come down to the interrogation room and give them a full confession after they tell them they didn't want to talk.
Here's an article from Radio Iowa. It says, Felon Voting Rights Restoration Clears Iowa House Panel. In a rare moment, the Republicans, Democrats on the committee unanimously embraced a plan for Governor Kim Reynolds on felon voting rights. This looks like it would give voting rights back to felons somewhere around 2022. I suspect that there are going to be carve-outs, though, of certain crimes that don't get them back. This would be a move in the right direction, but it's not going to be, you know, you're not kicking the ball through the goal, through the goalposts.
Well, you notice they carved out sex offenders. And
It does say that there. It's such a short article. I almost missed it. It says,
The Republican said that he strongly supported keeping those people should lose their rights forever.
So for murder, rape, and child sex abuse from voting, those are the three carve outs, which is pretty typical.
Yep. So,
but it's something. I mean, you know, I mean, they restored what, 1.4 million people in Florida to vote. I still, Larry, that one still bothers me so bad that it was a constitutional amendment back right after the Civil War. So whatever, like the 1870s or 80s is when that got put on the Florida, amended to the Constitution. It was Amendment Number 4. That's how old it is. And they just finally reversed it.
Oh, well, it takes time. But I think what I saw some data just recently. We've played Rush Limbaugh saying that the reason why that passed was to get more Democrat voters, as he calls them, for the Democrat Party, as he calls it. But the data is showing that the people are registering in the Republican Party. And I said, I don't think that Rush is right on this, because the people that you think are going to be so conservative, I mean, so liberal, actually turned out to be quite conservative, as the people in our movement do. I mean, I'm thinking from my experience of 10 years of advocacy, about 3/4 of the people that I run into, or maybe even more, are solidly on the conservative side. And I said, well, you know, you do realize you're voting for all the stuff that's keeping us down, don't you? And they said, well, I got to look at the bigger picture. And I said, what's the bigger picture? And they'll say, well, prayer in the schools, same-sex marriage, and, you know, things like that, that they have to look at the bigger picture. But the data showing in that Florida that the people that are registering are not registering with the Democrat Party. They're registering with the Republican Party.
I'm sorry, what party?
Republican.
Oh, okay. I thought I heard you say con at the end there.
Well, if they can't pronounce our party correctly, I don't see any reason to pronounce theirs correctly. It's the Democratic Party.
Oh, and I see.
When they take such great satisfaction in butchering the name of the Democratic Party, you are a Democrat, but you're a member of the Democratic Party. And it's my way of poking back at them. If they can't pronounce our party correctly, I don't see any reason to pronounce the Republican Party correctly.
And then our penultimate article comes from the Indiana Lawyer. Divided COA, which I don't know what COA is.
Court of Appeals.
Divided Court of Appeals. Amendment bars sex offender from son's school activities. This isn't the one that we covered a couple weeks ago where we played the parent saying that she wouldn't feel right. She would feel a oogie by having her kid in school with this guy. That's not this guy, is it?
I'm not sure if it is or not. It looks like too recent to be. It looks like this one just came down.
Okay. But here we go. And this guy had been going to the school functions. If I remember right how I read this, he was able to go. And then they made a law after his sentence and maybe even after he got out that prevented him from going. So now he can't go. So he filed a ex post facto kind of claim. Have I reiterated this halfway correctly, or do I have
something completely different?
Okay.
Yeah, he did it close enough. He filed a declaratory judgment.
What is a declaratory judgment then?
It's a vehicle where you ask the court to declare your rights under law, and it's one of the best vehicles used to challenge the registration statute. People end up trying to do it in post-conviction and all sorts of mechanisms that are not the best. The declaratory judgment gives you the opportunity to build an evidentiary record.
Okay, and this says the Howard Superior Court found the statute unconstitutional as applied to his circumstances after noting that he had been previously able to attend his son's school's functions and sporting events before the statute's amendment. So it feels to me like this is very much like almost all of our other post-conviction, the additions added to the registry, you know, like the Alaska people, they didn't have living restrictions. Well, now they probably have living restrictions, or now they have work restrictions. They have internet restrictions. They have all these extra restrictions that weren't in place when the sentence was handed down. This feels, you know, this is just yet another thing of something that our people can't do that was added after the fact.
And the court in this case found that this was not a sufficient disability to under the seven factors that we've talked about, the Kennedy, Mendoza, Martinez seven factors. They didn't find that this one exclusion was sufficient enough that it was punitive. And of course I disagree with them, but that's what they concluded.
All right.
So I guess he's got one more appeal he can do to the Indiana Supreme Court.
Got it.
So,
and that's it's a very conservative state too.
Well, that's the best place to be. The conservatives are going to be our salvation.
Outstanding. Let's not go down that road again.
I don't know why you don't understand that. What the hell's wrong with you people?
I know, right? And our final article is, you can find this in a bunch of different sources, but the one that I grabbed was 13 WMAZ. It's a Macon, Georgia news outlet. It says, lifelong monitoring of sexually dangerous predators, unconstitutional Georgia Supreme Court rules. This was a unanimous decision. These are people that it wasn't part of their sentence. I guess almost identical to what we were just talking about. But this, so if you got listed upon release as a sexually dangerous predator, I think, or sexually dangerous predator, then you would have to wear lifelong monitoring. And the Supreme Court here in Georgia said that you couldn't do that because it violated your Fourth Amendment. They did not say that you can't make it happen. It would have to be part of your sentence. But so this is pretty good news.
Well, you did such a good job on this. I think we can wrap this thing up.
All right. Shut it down. We're out.
So, well, under Georgia has this risk-based system, and he was under the Sex Offender Registration Review Board, the SORRB. They found him to be a sexually dangerous predator. And through that criteria and through that process, he appealed that and lost. He appealed the board's decision and he lost, but they changed the law and required that he be fitted for GPS and pay for it for the rest of his life. And so he ended up violating that requirement. I think he monkeyed with the GPS the way I read the opinion.
He did. Yeah. As soon as the sentence was over, he started monkeying with it. And then that instituted him to get into court pretty much on the spot. Right.
And then that's one way to get in court. I tell people, you can file a declaratory judgment like we just talked about, or you can tell people to take their law and shove it. And that's essentially what he did when he mucked it with the GPS. And you can challenge the constitutionality through the Georgia process worked amazingly well. He did what's called an interlocutory appeal. They charged him with violating the requirement of the GPS monitoring. And an interlocutory appeal is rarely granted, but it's a type of appeal that's limited to where if the decision on the interlocutory appeal would be dispositive, meaning dispose of the entire case without a trial, the interlocutory appeal will sometimes be granted. And they granted an interlocutory appeal to determine whether the statute was unconstitutional. And they found that it was, which that was dispositive to his charge of violating it because it's unconstitutional. But I think people, we're going to link to this opinion, and people should pay careful attention to some parts I've highlighted, because I frequently tell people on these and other presentations that everything is presumed constitutional until it's shown otherwise. So if you turn to page 6 on the opinion, and they rejected he tried to relitigate, his name was Park, he tried to relitigate the Sex Offender Review Board's decision, and they said, nope, that's done, and that's closed, that's behind us. But what is properly before, turn to the issue that's properly before us, Park contends that OCGA 42-1-14E is unconstitutional on its face because it authorizes an unreasonable lifelong warrantless search of offenders who are classified as sexually dangerous by requiring each offender to wear and be monitored at all times through a GPS. And then it says, evaluating this claim, listen carefully, we recognize at the onset that all presumptions are in favor of the constitutionality of the act of the legislature, and that before an act of the legislature can be declared unconstitutional, the conflict between it and fundamental law must be clear and palpable, and this court must be clearly satisfied of its unconstitutionality. Moreover, because statutes are assumed to be constitutional until the contrary appears, the burden is on the party alleging the statute to be unconstitutional to prove it. So it's not old crazy Larry telling you this is the jurisprudence. This is the two centuries of evolution of what our courts, the deference they give to the legislature. So the legislature was presumed that they enacted something that was constitutional, and it would be operating just fine, except for Park said, well, I don't think it is. Right. And if Park had not said that, this is not a roving tribunal that was looking for something to find unconstitutional when they woke up on the morning of the 4th. This was a party who brought a challenge because he was facing prosecution and imprisonment, and he said, I don't believe the legislature got it right. That's the reason how this got before the court. And he alleged it was facially unconstitutional, which is even higher a burden. If you look on the next page, it says, furthermore, outside the First Amendment, overbreadth context, and that's an exception where you can actually litigate a little more freely, a plaintiff can succeed in a facial challenge only by establishing that no set of circumstances exist under which the statute would be valid, i.e. that the law is unconstitutional in all its applications, or at least that the statute lacks a plainly legitimate sweep. And he had a high burden, and he met that burden.
Can we go back? This word drives me crazy. I hear this used often. It's a facial challenge. And by golly, the only word that I know that's I will tell. There's one that I know that you get a facial, so like a big cleansing at the makeup shop. There's another one that's a facial that I don't want to go into. It's not appropriate. But then there's this legal term for facial.
Well, there's inconstitutionality as applied and on its face. When something is argued to be facially inconstitutional, you're telling the court that just looking at what's in the black letters, that they can't do this under any set of circumstances. And that's what he was arguing here, that you people can't make a law that says that I'll be monitored and searched and have my data seized for the rest of my life after I've paid my debt to society, which was the crucial deciding factor. He had exited the justice system. And he said that you just can't do it. It would be tantamount to saying you can't leave your house on Sunday morning between the hours of 8 and
right.
Stances where that short of martial law, that would be constitutional. That would be unconstitutional on its face. As applied, that's a different type of challenge. As applied is a challenge where you might be able to do it, but you couldn't do it under this set of circumstances. I actually do think this is more of an as applied than a facial challenge. I think that they went a little bit further than what they should have, but that's their prerogative being the Supreme Court. I think that there would be circumstances where you could monitor a person for the rest of their life if it was part of their sentence. That lifetime supervision was spelled out plainly in the statute, and when you took your plea or you got convicted, you were apprised that this is a part of what you're going to have to do as your punishment. So I think that there is maybe a little bit of overreach here, but if you're off supervision, the court said you can't have your stuff seized. And they relied on a U.S. Supreme Court decision on North Carolina not that many years ago, I think 2015, see Grady versus North Carolina. And they relied on that, which is on page 8, where the United States Supreme Court said, of course, a GPS monitor is a search. What the hell do you think it is?
Right. I do. I remember that one where the officers would just like plant one on your car and like, no, you have to go put boots on the ground and follow those people around. You can't just do some sort of passive monitoring of people.
Yeah. And I think Grady was a case of sex offender statute similar to Georgia. They said we can just do this and it's not a search, and the Supreme Court said, well, actually it is. And when you're going to track someone and the mere fact that they're convicted of a crime, the state of Georgia argued relentlessly in this that, well, this data is already out. No, this data isn't out there. The fact that he's been convicted of a sex offense, that's out there. But where he moves, where he goes, and the fact that he has to have an irritating device that he has to pay for, which adds insult to the injury, attached to him seizing that data for the rest of his life against his will, that is clearly a search, according to the Supreme Court of the United States and the Supreme Court of Georgia.
This then also feels to me that this sets up all kinds of other post-supervision kind of challenges that people could bring up. You know, the Packingham stuff in North Carolina is on par with this. There's all kinds of other stuff that people Absolutely. Would be able to challenge post-supervision.
Absolutely. This
pretty,
is actually
pretty much everything.
Building the body of case law that I've been preaching about for some time, I don't want people to have to ever register under any set of circumstances because I think it's a bad policy. But I think you could constitutionally get away with it while you're being punished. But when you have paid your debt to society, you can't continue to do to people what you can do when they're paying the debt to society. And this is a good read because it tells you that all through the opinion, that they recognize that things can be done to a person who has lesser expectation of privacy and lesser liberty expectations. But once you pay that debt to society, you're done. If you offend again, we will lock you up again.
Right.
That's what the answer is when people say, what do we do next if they offend again? Well, we prosecute you again.
And you'll look at the person's history and you'll give them a harsher sentence because, hey, you're not a first offender or whatever you want to call it. So that was one of the things with Manafort. It was like, this guy, he's never been in a courtroom before. So why should we give him, throw the book at him all the way? This is his first time offending. So same thing here. It would be easier to argue saying, hey, the person has been in here before. He committed this kind of crime before. Here he is back. Let's give him an extreme sentence, him or her.
So, and I guess to page 15, I would call you, and I agree with you on what you just said about the future with Packingham, and we're getting a body of case law that I've been saying we'll get if people make these arguments. On page 15, it says, although individuals classified as sexually dangerous predators do not have a diminished expectation of privacy after they've served the entirety of their sentence, this does not end our inquiry, and we must still determine if the GPS monitoring requirements may be proper as a reasonable special needs search. Now, I'm not an expert at all in reasonable special needs search, so we're going to have to develop that. But they make it clear that once you've paid your debt to society, that you just can't continue to do what you can do in terms of diminishing people's expectations. You don't have the right to travel as a regular citizen does while you're paying your debt to society. People get mad at me, but I say, well, why won't they let me travel to Rhode Island to see my uncle or my cousin? Because they don't have to. You're being punished. That's not a right you enjoy. But once you pay that debt to society, you go to Rhode Island or any other damn place you want to go. And you shouldn't have any interference from government on where you want to go and how you want to travel and how long you want to stay there and where you want to be present. That's none of government's business until you break the laws again and government has the opportunity to intervene again and put boundaries around you. But he should be free to do anything he wants to do without any governmental intrusion unless he offends again.
I suspect those in Georgia can expect something to come down the pike later that would amend the sentencing structure to say that if you – oh, man, they can't classify you before your sentence, can they?
No, they couldn't, but they could. I think they could craft, and I'm sure all the Georgia General Assembly is listening to this. What they could do is say that they could say that a person who, upon release from incarceration, shall undergo a review to make sure that they have been properly risk assessed and that the court may modify their sentence. And that would be questionably constitutional, but it would be presumed constitutional until it was challenged. And they could try to retain jurisdiction of the Superior Court to modify the sentence to include this requirement, and then it would be a part of their sentence. So all the people that are listening in Georgia that work for the General Assembly, that you're going to have to be very, very cagey about how you do it. And then someone else would have to challenge that, but they could try to craft something that would bring that back with the zone of the sentence of the person. But it's hard to classify a person exactly until they get released. But I guess that'd be another way they could do it. They could make sure that before they pronounce sentence, that they send the person to the SORB first, and have them classified. And then that would be a way they could do it at the front end of the sentence.
Very, very interesting. Well, this is another victory. Larry, I'm telling you, we've been doing this podcast for about 18 months, and when we started, it was a struggle to find good news, and now this is like the fourth, fifth, or sixth episode where we had some positive legal outcome that we've covered as like the feature thing of the show. I mean, am I reading the tea leaves and being too optimistic that all this windfall is coming down and we're going to have more and more victories that are going to stack on top of this, or did we just like, this is where the everything just melded together.
I think the cases, the practice of law is like anything else. It evolves, and lawyers get better at doing things when they try enough times. And funding has been a big part of the problem. But also, as case law, as decisions come down, the court lets us know what we did wrong and what we didn't prove and where we had a hope of doing better. And you go back and you hopefully litigate better. So each time there's a decision, that goes against us, we learn. And each time there's a decision that's in favor, we learn. And I can assure you that all this is only valid in Georgia. There's already attorneys looking at this that have similar requirements and saying, wow, that's a fantastic analysis from the Georgia Supreme Court. And they're going to use some of this dicta and some of these analyses. They're going to use this in their arguments in their states. So this the momentum is building because
– Well, that's what I was asking. That's totally what I was asking then.
Yes. Yes, because we're learning how to do this better. We're learning what we didn't know 15 years ago.
Okay. And it takes that long for someone to get through their sentence to then end up on GPS monitoring so they can try and take it off so that they can get arrested for tampering with it so they can push this all the way up to the Supreme Court. And just – did we ever say he was released from prison in 2011? So when did he come off of supervision? In February 2016 was arrested and indicted.
He got revoked and went back, and I think he got out in 2015. He was released from custody in April 2015, and then he was.
This doesn't seem like it took that long then.
Well, no, he didn't. It didn't take. I mean, 4 years is long enough, but
it is. It is.
He got it. So it took him from 15 to 19 to get this litigated all the way up to the state Supreme Court. Yeah, but he violated he tampered with it quite early. In February 2016, Park was arrested and indicted for tampering with the ankle monitor. So it didn't. So it took him from 16 to 19, basically 3 years. That's not uncommon for this type of litigation. And the great thing is they granted the interlocutory appeal because oftentimes without that option, he'd had to have gone to trial, had been convicted, and made an appeal and probably be behind bars, but he didn't have to do that. He got an interlocutory and they decided that it was unconstitutional. He never has to face trial on this.
Interesting. That's very good. Well, groovy. So we have another good news segment at the end of the show. Someone had asked several months ago, I was like, why can't you guys have any good news? Like, I don't know. There's not a whole lot of good news, but here we are again with some good news.
We do have good news. And I thought we'd get some feedback about the Third Circuit, about the habeas corpus. I haven't heard a peep of anybody about that. We talked about the Third Circuit case last week.
Yes. No, and I know, but that's what I'm saying. Like for a while, we didn't have anything positive to say. And now that's what I'm saying is like for the last half dozen episodes or so, we've had very positive outcomes of different cases. You know, the attorney general thing, you know, there's just been this whole.
Well, but I'm posing the question back now that we had the positive news. How come we aren't getting positive feedback? The people that said, why don't you people have anything positive?
Oh.
Why aren't you people saying thank you for the positive? And why aren't we hearing feedback about the positive?
I suspect that we will hear it now that you've made a big deal about it. Well, let's shut this down, Larry. Are you ready to shut it down? Do you have anything else you want to say?
Well, I think we've done a great job, and I'd like to know how people can be supportive of Registry Matters. What would be the best way to support us?
The absolute best way? Let's see here. Okay, so we need to go find one of those lottery winners, and we need to go get them to open up their checkbook and just write something with a whole lot of zeros at the end of it and contribute that to the podcast. That would be the best way.
Why not just give the guy that his tickets were, he dropped the tickets and then someone turned him in and he got his tickets back? Did you hear about that one recently?
I think I did. There was somebody that just did the generous act of giving somebody else the tickets.
Well, no, I think he lost them. Then someone said, hey, I found these. And then I think he got back to the purchaser, if I understood it right. But I think that why wouldn't we just recommend that they turn the entire ticket over to Registry Matters?
Oh, I think that's an excellent idea. So, and then somebody in the chat said, rob a bank and drop off the stash. We can't condone any sort of illegal activities in supporting the podcast, though. So I don't want to know where the cash came from.
So, all right.
But visit the website.
We rolled that one out.
Okay. Yeah. We have to overrule and we can't do that one. But the website is registrymatters.co. We could probably like go back in time and figure out why I registered a CO domain and not a .com domain. I have no idea now why I did that. But whatever, it's a .co. And we have this great phone number that's a whole lot of airplane numbers with some twos. So we have 747-227-4477. And those of you that are trying to write it down, it's 747-227-4477. Larry loves to receive voicemail messages so that we can posit and contemplate all these different ideas that people send us. If you want to shoot us an email message, it's registrymatterscast@gmail.com. That's not like the cast of the show. That's actually for podcast. but I guess it doesn't matter because it's the same four letters. And then to support the podcast, the best way and the most appreciated way, we love all of our listeners, but the ones that do Patreon, we love them the mostest, is patreon.com. That's patreon.com/registrymatters.
All righty. And then how can they be in live chat so they can actually converse with us, even though I never watch that thing, but I hear it dinging all throughout the recording.
Oh, we need to figure out, I need to show you how to turn that into a streamer mode so it doesn't bother you. But there's a Discord server. You can find a link in the show notes. I'm not going to give you the funky characters at the end of it, but if you want to join in and you can listen to us talk about this or hang out during the week, because we talk about all kinds of craziness, pass articles around and discuss things. I'm going to eventually get you in here and to talk with some of these political nuts and their crazy ideas about different policies that they want to implement, and see, get you to push back on them, because they're all nuts.
Now, you can't say that. They can't all be nuts.
They're pretty freaking crazy. And they're all in there saying, hey, it's me. Nope, it's me. Nope, it's me. We love you guys very much. I can't tell you how much I appreciate having you people to talk to during the week. I really, really do. Very much appreciate it.
So,
and that's all I got, Larry.
Well, it's good for you to have me back this week. I appreciate it very much.
I very much appreciate you having it. Actually, there were people in the chat room saying, God, man, Larry really knows his stuff. So, yeah, you really do. And I very much appreciate you being here with me every week.
Well, I got him snowed really well, haven't I?
That's probably true. So I appreciate it, Larry, and I will talk to you very soon.
All right. Thanks. Good night.
Bye.
You've been listening to FYP.